All right, we're going to bring the House Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Time is 9:07. Today's Friday, March 29th. With us so far are Senator Olson, welcome.
Good morning, Senator Chairman.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, and Vice Chair Senator Fairclough. So we have a quorum to conduct business. On today's agenda, we're going to begin hearings on Senate Bill 49, Medicaid payment for abortions. And also keep in mind today, we do have a floor session at 10, so we'll get as far as we can this morning and then finish at least the orientation and discussion of the bill this afternoon, and then have public testimony tomorrow, Saturday, at 1 o'clock. So if you're here for public testimony, that won't be till tomorrow. All right, if there's anything to come before the committee, then let's just get started on the bill. I'll like to invite the sponsor to the table, Senator Coghill, and it looks like his trusty staff. Senator Coghill, if you could introduce the bill to us and field some questions from us. I see we have the commissioner here as well. Commissioner will discuss the fiscal note with us, but let's go ahead and hear from the sponsor. Before you get started, Senator Kelly has joined us. Welcome, Senator Kelly. Co-Chair Kelly. Senator Coghill, the floor is yours.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 49 today. Senate Bill 49, I have Chad Hutchison, who is going to help me navigate some of the technical questions. But just from the sponsor statement, and I think in the little booklet that I gave you, it's a tab 2, just to kind of give you the high-level view of what this bill is all about, it's really to bring clarity to the term medical necessity. So the medical necessary abortion for the purpose of making payments to Medicaid. So under Medicaid right now, we paid for, I don't know the exact number, but it was like 37% of about 1,600 abortions in Alaska. So it's a big question. It's been brought to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court made a ruling that medically necessary abortions should be paid for, but they did not bring the definition. So it was in 2001, if you'll notice in the sponsor statement, they must pay for medically necessary abortions. But since 2001, we have not really defined the term medical necessity. So the question that we are raising in this particular bill is how do we define the difference between a medically necessary abortion and an elective abortion? That is kind of the simple part of it. I think we found a good answer in Senate Bill 49. It brings recommendations from a variety of experts, both legal and medical. Probably the criteria that we have to follow, and I'm going to quote something out of a legal opinion. The state is permitted to distinguish between two types of abortions, those that are elective and those that are medically necessary, by way of neutral criteria that are related to the purposes of the public health care program. And that is a legal review of the Planned Parenthood decision in 2001. And that's what we're trying to do, is trying to find that neutral criteria that says for these reasons we find that's medically necessary. In Alaska and in many places throughout the United States, this particular issue, as contentious as it is probably the most litigated because of the Supreme Court cases that follow it and the Supreme Court cases in Alaska that have followed it. It doesn't always fit into the general Medicaid criteria. That's why you have to deal with this in a very different way than you would almost any other Medicaid issues. But to be fair, Medicaid only pays for medically necessary treatments. Then that's open to discussion what that is. Generally, it's a coded issue. They pay based on this code. They're not going to give you facelifts, for example, finding them not medically necessary. That's probably on the outskirts. But because of the highly litigated area of abortion, you're going to have to fine-tune that into a little different and specific criteria, but still under this neutral criteria. So in the Judiciary Committee where we heard this, I think we had somewhere over 60 people testify. We had professional doctors so that we could talk about the medical terms in this bill. And the reason we had to do that was the Supreme Court actually brought up the medical terms, and we took those terms and looked through them with professionals on both sides of the question and came up with what we thought was a list that would satisfy both the Supreme Court and what would be good medically necessary criteria. We also looked at it from a purely legal perspective on how do you get that neutral criteria. And we had public testimony and legal testimony on both sides of those. And I think we came up with what we would consider a very good bill that would describe medical necessity, still giving leeway to the doctors for their professional decision making. At the end of the day, it comes down to defining what is the physical criteria for the life and health well-being of the mother. And she gets to make the choice. And this does not restrict abortions in any way. It really is only defining when is the state going to pay for it and when does it become elective and the patient has to pay for it. That's the issue at hand. We gave ample opportunity for both lawyers from Planned Parenthood and health professionals under Planned Parenthood, and we brought in doctors who had other views than Planned Parenthood. We had both national doctors and doctors in the state of Alaska testify, and you'll find some of that in your tabs. And when Mr. Hutchison gets to go through those tabs, I think you'll see that it was a very thorough review. ACLU chimed in. And so the health review was taken very seriously. So in the Judiciary Committee, I think we had six hearings altogether. It was six hearings. Some 60-odd people, 60 people, no, they're not odd, I'm sorry, testifying. 60 plus, you know, a few. If you look in the bill real quickly, I will not spend a bunch of time on this, but in the bill, the last section talks about serious risk to the life or health, physical health. It includes but not limited to the serious risk to the pregnancy of the woman. So what we tried to do is give the doctor the discretion, but give the people who have to pay an idea of when it would be considered medically necessary. The doctor still gets to choose. The other thing that we put in this bill is the criteria that comes from what is normally called the Hyde Amendment, and that deals with rape and incest. They will pay for those. To date, I don't know of any in Alaska that have been paid for under that provision. I have a list here that I could probably distribute, and is it in the packet? I think I have a list of how many Hyde Amendment abortions have been paid for in Alaska, and I don't think of any in the last 10 years, especially probably since this court case has been brought up. But it's a decision that we made that we put it in a bill. It was part of the Supreme Court case that they put that in as part of the criteria. So we thought, let's go ahead and establish that, put in the life health risk, physical health risk, and give the doctor discretion. Then we have what I'd consider a good framework to say, these are going to be medically necessary. All others will be elective. Then whoever pays for it will be able to see very clearly the criteria. So that's the kind of the overview of the bill. I can go through it section by section if you wish, Mr. Chairman. I can have Chad Hutchison kind of go through the packet that we've given you. Maybe that would be the better thing to do. And I just gave you the overview. Any questions for me as a sponsor?
Well, thank you, Senator Coghill. I believe, and I know you did an excellent job in the Judiciary Committee hearing the legal aspects of the bill. So we're going to try to avoid as much as possible the legal or judiciary-related questions about the bill and try to focus a little bit more on the financial side of it. But if you want to have your, if you want to have Chad there go through the bill so that we understand what's in the bill, that would be fine.
Why don't we do that, Mr. Okay. Chairman? And I'll sit here available for questions.
Very good. Well, let me just see. Is there any questions for the sponsor before we go on? Okay. Very good. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chad Hutchison. I'm part of the staff for Senator Coghill. We've had questions about how we got here with regards to the language in the bill, so I'm just going to go through that, give a brief executive summary as to the federal foundation and the terms that we've used, so it's explained to everybody and everyone has a thorough understanding. Our definition incorporates the statutory foundation found in the federal Hyde Amendment. It's what Senator Coghill was referencing. That's an important piece of legislation, and you're going to hear that over and over. This is so important, in fact, that President Obama had an executive order that specifically referenced that when he passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. That's on tab 4. The executive order is 1353 as of March 24, 2010. And it specifically states that it is necessary to establish an adequate enforcement mechanism to ensure that federal funds are not used for abortion except in cases of rape or incest, or when the life of the woman would be endangered, consistent with the longstanding federal statutory restriction that is commonly known as the Hyde Amendment. So right from the very beginning, we have to know that in SB 49, we have to include provisions for rape, incest, or if the life of the mother is endangered. And as you can see from reviewing tab 1, the language of the bill, that is included. If you have any more questions about what the Hyde Amendment says, I encourage you to read tab 7 in your packets. Next, you have to look and see what the protections are provided with regards to the Alaska Constitution. The federal foundation is here. The Alaska Constitution allows for one extra layer of protection. We've addressed that by including provisions that say that it is not limited to the conditions that we have listed here, and it includes the physical health of the mother. So that's one extra layer above and beyond just a life-threatening circumstance with the mother or in the cases of rape or incest. So those provisions are also included in the definition that we've provided in SB 49. I want to take a little bit to talk about the context for SB 49 because that isn't important, and Senator Coghill did an excellent job of touching on that, but we just want to make sure that this is absolutely clear, is that Medicaid does not fund elective procedures, therefore Medicaid shall not fund elective abortions. Medicaid does fund medically necessary procedures, therefore Medicaid will fund medically necessary abortions. The problem is the definition has been so unclear up to this point that we believe in good faith that elective procedures and medically necessary procedures have been included in the old previous definition. So that's what we're here to rectify. That's what SB 49 does. I encourage everyone to read tab 4A in your packets. It provides a little statistical context as to what other states do in comparison to Alaska.
Did you say 4A?
4A, Senator Kelly, through the chair. On the left-hand column of the second page, it's a report provided by the Guttmacher Institute, and it essentially states, the title is, for everybody listening, is State Funding of Abortion Under Medicaid, and it lists 32 states plus the District of Columbia that just follow the federal foundational platform. So that's life endangerment, that's rape and incest. You'll see on the right-hand column, it says that all funds all or most medically necessary abortions. And you will see that Alaska does fall in that category. There's 17 states that have a court order or it's voluntarily based on provisions that they've passed through their respective state governments. Alaska specifically is listed as a court order. And a lot of people ask, well, what is the court order? Well, the answer is the 2001 Planned Parenthood decision. That's where a lot of this language comes from. So if you go to section 4C in your packets, that is the actual language of the this is 4C in the packets that were provided to all the committee members. This is the language. This is the Planned Parenthood case, And if I could have everybody refer to page 16, and it should be highlighted in everyone's packet. Page 16 is basically why we're all here, and the highlighted provision specifically states, and I'll read it out loud, the state, having undertaken to provide health care for poor Alaskans, must adhere to neutral criteria in distributing care. It may not deny medically necessary services to eligible individuals based on criteria unrelated to the purposes of the public health care program. And that's all we're trying to do with SB 49, provide a definition based on neutral criteria directly related to the health care program. So why is this all important? Senator Coghlan and I have discussed it a little bit before, but I want to show you some more statistics that justify our position. We reasonably believe that Medicaid is covering elective procedures and medically necessary procedures. Well, how do we know that? Please go to tab 8 in your packets. Tab 8 is a document provided by the Alaska Bureau of Vital Statistics. The title also says Induced Termination of Pregnancy Statistics. I'm looking at table 18 and table 19, and the relevant portions are highlighted for should be highlighted for the committee in their packet. You can see that out of a total 1,627 abortions performed last year, 623 were covered under Medicaid, and that equates to approximately 38.3% of total abortions covered under Medicaid. So in theory, that should be abortions that were because of rape or incest or medically necessary provisions. Okay, so that's the standard that we have, 38.3%. Next, go to tab 9 in your packets. Tab 9 is, I'll title for the people listening, is Reasons U.S. Women Have Abortions, Quantitative and Qualitative Perspectives. It's provided by the Guttmacher Institute, which we, in judiciary, we vetted Guttmacher, and they are a very thorough and credible source on these sorts of statistics. Please join me on listed page 114, and there's two highlighted provisions. We're referencing table 3. In the upper left-hand corner on page 114. It says table 3, percentage distribution of women having an abortion by their most important reason for having an abortion. And it compares 2004 versus 1987. We'll go with 2004. In 2004, the highlighted portion for the committee says that physical problem with my health only accounted for 4% of reasons, the primary reasons for getting an abortion. Was a victim of rape is the next portion of the head, less than 0.5%. So what we're essentially looking at is, as far as the primary reason for getting an abortion, we have 4.5% approximately, if you include rape, incest, or physical conditions on this side, and we have 38.3% on this side. These are all the abortions that are being covered by the state of Alaska under Medicaid. That's quite a gap, and it's our reasonable supposition from looking at these statistics that a lot of elective procedures are actually being covered under the current definition of Medicaid, and that's a problem, and that's the reason why SB 49 is here in front of you now. It narrows the definition. It's based on neutral criteria directly related to the healthcare field. We had a thorough vetting down in judiciary. We had three national experts, medical experts, with regards to abortions across country talk on the subject. We had 7 to 8 doctors from Alaska. We had the public come in and give their testimony. We had pro-choice doctors. We had the ACLU. We had Planned Parenthood. We gave everybody a thorough chance to review the bill up to this point, and we're confident in the language that we've included because it's been thoroughly vetted by both the medical experts and the legal experts. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Hutchinson, is it Hutchins or Hutchinson?
Hutchinson, through the chair.
Okay, Senator Dunleavy has a question for you.
Thank you, through the chair. Going back to the tab that has the states listed on the left, state funding of abortion under Medicaid. That's under tab, what tab is that under?
4A. Senator Dunleavy, 4A.
4A?
Sure.
And as you go down on the left-hand side, you have all the states. You have South Dakota with an asterisk, and the asterisk says state only pays for abortions when necessary to protect a woman's life. So would they be in violation of what's currently prescribed by the federal government?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, that is correct, and that's not the model that we necessarily want to use. They are considered the outlier, but not something that it's not going to be relevant for our purposes anyway, because the 2001 Planned Parenting decision does have controlling influence over the language of this bill. And there's always going to be a little bit of a variance in all the different states, but you are correct, that is the outlier, but that's not necessarily the model that we can use in the state of Alaska.
Tell me why.
Because our laws, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, because we have the 2001 Planned Parenthood decision, and that is the controlling box, the legal box that we're confined in.
So it wasn't a law that the legislature passed, it was a court order.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, that is correct, and we're using that as a model to come up with a thorough analytical bill that can work and pass constitutional muster.
Dunleavy. Senator Huffman.
Thank you. Maybe the chairman or maybe the department can answer this, but under this legislation, how does a second opinion be treated under this bill? If one expecting mother comes up and says that it is medically necessary. Mm-hmm. Is it allowed that the mother can get a second opinion?
The answer is, I don't know the specific answer to that question, but my expectation would be that is between the patient and the doctor. So if they're not satisfied with what one doctor says, then they may very well go to another doctor. And I'm not too sure how Medicaid would see that. And maybe that's something that the commissioner can help us on. But when somebody is seeking Medicaid services, I don't know how much choice they get in going from one doctor to another based on second opinions.
But it seems as though if it's medically necessary and we're talking about the well-being of the mother, the life and the health of the mother, that this is very critical, and it would seem that a second opinion under those very strenuous circumstances would be welcome.
Mm-hmm. That would be my expectation, that would be true.
Yeah, I do think that's a good question for the commissioner, and we'll have him up next after these gentlemen. And I'm not sure I got the number of how many abortions you believe occurred that were not that were elective and not medically necessary. And I know you were talking about 38%, but I didn't hear any.
Mr. Chairman, there were 1,629 abortions. 38% of those were paid for by Medicaid dollars. At this point, we can only extrapolate that less than 6% of them were what we would consider under the medically necessary. So we're extrapolating that, but that may very well not be true. So there's a larger range. But if you look at what the Guttmacher Institute put forward as reasons that women get abortions, nearly 50% of them were either because of job-related or convenience issues. So those were things that should have been paid for as elective. That would be my expectation.
And if I could just make sure that we clarify the numbers, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, tab 8 is the 2011 numbers, and that's the figures that we have been relying on as far as our statistical analysis, and the total amount was 1,627 total abortions, and the amount paid for by Medicaid in 2011 was 623, equating to 38.3% of all abortions in 2011. I just want to make sure clear about those figures.
Okay, and then, my question will probably be for the commissioner when we talk about the fiscal note, but I should know this, but I don't. So Medicaid picks these portions up. Most of that is federal money, and a certain percent is state money. Or how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, I can give you at least the high level conversation on that. None were paid for by Hyde amendments, which would have been 100%. the Medicaid mix then is probably 60-40 or 50-50, depending on the year that you're reporting. And so at this point, the feds would pay for half, the state would pay for half, but it would be under the Medicaid of Alaska's management.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Senator Kelly?
Senator Coghill, I lost my place in the tabs here. So nationwide, according to the Guttmacher Institute, 0.5% of abortions are for medically necessary or rape or incest. Is that correct?
Under rape and incest, that is correct. That's that would be tab 9 on the last page 114 of that particular report. So 0.5% was victim of rape. So the 4% were physical problems with health.
Oh, so all right. So we should anticipate 4.5% or somewhere in that neighborhood would be a reasonable number. Obviously, it's a different universe that you're drawing from. You're talking about national statistics, all people, and then when you get to the Medicaid number, that's a different universe. But certainly, 4.5% would be a starting point to determine what is a reasonable number of people that should be in that pool, and it would possibly grow from there for many different reasons, but it seems that 38% versus 4.5%, we're obviously way out of whack there. Something's going on. Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that. I thought it was 0.5% was for all categories, rape and incest and medically right. necessary, but it's 4.5%.
And, Mr. Chairman, to be fair, we're taking a national right. average and trying to apply it to a state number. So they may not fit as closely some, but we don't have the statistical capacity right now to know that in Alaska. So we're taking national averages and trying to apply them to where we're at.
Yeah, and I if there's some apples to oranges going on here, and I understand right. that, but the fact is that apples to oranges should be somewhere in a different number. The disparity is just too much, even though you are doing some.
That's what we were trying to demonstrate, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Senator Dunleavy?
It's a quick question. I think I heard something. You say something. I just want to clarify. If this law passes, the funding for any abortions in Alaska would be federal money then?
Well, they're Medicaid dollars, Mr. Chairman. The Medicaid dollar is a state-federal partnership. And that's something that the commissioner can probably speak to more effectively than me, but I think that's a 50-50 split.
Currently,
the only place that I think that it's different is under Title 10, and I think that's family planning, but I don't think that falls under this category. Yeah.
Right. Senator Fairclough?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a couple questions, and I appreciate clarifying the definition around the different court opinions and the challenge that has. But because you've added that if someone indicates that they were raped or they're a victim of incest, that that is a qualification to be able to continue forward. So I'm wondering what you envision for a doctor's ability to comply with, first of all, the definition that you're proposing. How do you see that happening? Is a doctor going to have a checklist and they have to checklist off under the submittal for the insurance form for the doctor to say it was medically necessary? How do you see the doctor complying?
Just this year, the administration did put together a certification form under their rules, and I think that's probably where that would fall is when they apply for payment, they would certify.
Follow-up? Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed on tab 4A that I'm sorry, I'm going between tabs. It's 4B. That Alaska it appears doesn't require any kind of Are we going to require counseling at all if someone indicates that they've been a victim of rape or incest? And then secondary to that, are you going to require a report to public safety if they disclose? Because those numbers are counted, and our state already has horrid numbers, and at least from the advocacy groups, that they believe that's underreported massively.
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, the doctors are mandatory reporters, so where they're required to report, they will. And then when outside of that, that's a question that I still have yet to get satisfied in my mind how that would work. It's a little different question than what we were going to, but I think you're hitting on a very important point is, first of all, who decides payment under rape? Secondly, who then reports? So under mandatory reporting, I think for minors and for sexual assault, they are mandatory reporters. Beyond that, I don't think we have rules that I know of to report on.
Senator Fairclough.
So, Mr. Chairman, where I'm going, it's wrapping back to judicial, but I don't know if you've brought it up, but there are victims that choose not to report for very personal reasons. And if they would become pregnant, that they are making a choice that will affect the rest of their lives. And so, one, I'm looking to see about counseling, but when I think about counseling, some people aren't ready to face a counselor either in disclosure. And certainly HIPAA would protect them from, or should protect them, that the medical doctor wouldn't take that information and go tell a police officer, because the state then becomes the person who has to prosecute. So if a victim can sometimes lose control of their own body that's already been happened in the violence that took place, and then the legal system will step in on behalf of that person if it's reported up to the police officer and mandate an investigation, and the state becomes, I believe, the plaintiff, that they take over, and the person, whether they want their position to go to court or not, may be faced with a very public documentation of what they wanted to remain private. So I'm just wondering how, during this process, I appreciate the work. I'm not trying to throw a wrench into the wagon, but women do not report rape, at least according to national studies. It's a very low percentage, like 10% or under. They believe 1 in 10 is actually reporting. And so are we starting them into a process here that it will be disclosed when they didn't want it disclosed? Or are they protected under HIPAA, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I think the senator brings up an excellent point. We tried not to bring that up in this particular bill. The fact is that's a problem already under the law that we live under right now. That's a problem. And two of the big problems are, number one, the privacy of the individual, the decision of the doctor, but then there's also those who are victimized who have to live under the position where they are told to go get an abortion and then return back to their oppressor, and nobody can tell. So I think what you've described is a problem that we're going to have to work on, but that problem already exists. This bill will not change that. That problem is a problem, though. There's two sides to that problem, isn't there? One of them is those who want to be protected, but those who don't get protection. And so I think you've brought up an issue that we're going to have to deal with as a society generally. This bill probably will not change that much because the court mandate already under rape and incest is there. And so we have yet to deal with it, and you're right, we must deal with it somehow.
Go ahead, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, the only thing that I will say is is that I support rape and incest being included as a provision to be able to move forward if that is the person's choice under the laws of the United States. But we may need to deal with it here in this bill, because what I can see happening is advocacy groups that understand that this provision is in this law will inform young people who seek their consulting that it's available. And so what I can see is if a woman is placed under that much stress and believes that her only option is an abortion, that we're going to see this box getting checked more. And so that's why I was looking at the statistics very hard under tab 8, looking at medical, the age that people are accessing medical services for abortions in Alaska. You know, 15, if you're looking at 24 and under, you're picking up a good portion of the abortions in the state. I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman. I'm just concerned that we're going to run those numbers up, and I'm concerned that Planned Parenthood will provide that as an option, and if people start checking that box, then we're going to see rape statistics that, if that's reported in the second phase, start to move up, and we're not going to know where that's happening at, and is it being triggered by a choice to access medical care, or is it being triggered by a choice that we're forcing reporting? So I'll just need to cogitate on that.
And, Mr. Chairman, there is one other element. Under this particular section of law, we also have an informed consent portion, where that would be probably the bigger question under the informed consent, because at that point the doctors are going to go through the conversation with the individual seeking an abortion. So the payment method is one thing, but the information going into it is quite another thing. And I can tell you that has been litigated pretty significantly as well.
Follow?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just need to hear from the Department of Law as to what is going to be the consequence of checking that, if there's a box, or is the doctor. I'll just need to understand those particular components so that we're clear on the chain of events that will be started if someone requests that. And I understand the numbers are significant under the Medicaid dollars, but it's still the state and then the Department of Law that will be adding investigations to, as well as other services.
And, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Hutchison had a comment on it.
And Senator Faircloth, to address your point, rape and incest has been included all the way back to the in certain provisions of the Hyde Amendment, going back to when it was initially incepted into law. The rape and incest provisions were available for reporting, and the numbers in 1987 and 2004 were, when rape and incest was one of the requirements in 2004, was still less than 0.5. So they had the option to mark off that box, but that's the statistics that they had on a nationwide basis. So maybe that addresses some of your question.
But I think, Mr. Chairman, it's true that in Alaska we fear that there's a greater problem than we really know about, and I totally agree with the senator's position. That's something that once we know that, what can we do about it is the question, and I agree, and I'm willing to work on that. I don't know that this is the place necessarily, but if it is the place, then I'll be open to discussion on that.
Senator Faircloth?
Mr. Chairman, my concern is for a person who's identifying themselves as a victim of rape, that they are treated with the respect that they deserve, that their life doesn't become public when they don't want it to, that the state doesn't take over on their behalf and somehow subject them to scrutiny that they had chosen not to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, that's a legal question that probably has many facets to it. Like I said before, there are those who are under duress who would not admit to it. There are those who want to go forward who don't want anybody to know. There are those who want out. That is a very complex law that we have to figure out.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. You know, I think what we will do this afternoon is we'll have some invited testimony, perhaps Department of Law. Definitely want the commissioner to go over the fiscal note with us. And then perhaps we'll hear some from a couple doctors on both sides of the issue.
Senator Kelly, you had a question for the sponsor?
Most of my question was answered, and I just the only comment I had on what Senator Fairclough was discussing is that it just seems that that is beyond the scope of this bill, though the concern is legitimate. It seems it's beyond what you're trying to accomplish because we already have a pool of people that are going through this process. We're just defining the process.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kelly, Senator Kelly, we're just defining when is it appropriate to pay and when is it appropriate not to pay. And so that is, but once you get into the definition, then it does arise the question under rape and incest or under any abortion at this point, because now you seriously going to ask the question, is this medically necessary? You're going to lean on the doctor's discretion with categorizing it as we've done. But that's in true in most Medicaid payments anyway. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a fraud element to find out people getting unnecessary either payments or procedures. So, but this is just a much more tense law because we're dealing with those very special issues that from the great abuse to the life of the child to the will of the mother. I mean, we have all those issues plus huge court case precedents, national precedent, and trying to figure out how can we ask the question, when is something truly elective? It really asks some very difficult questions. I think we've hit a pretty good balance, though, in this approach.
Okay, very good. You know, Senator Fairclough brought up the counseling aspect, which is a very important aspect. And are some of these people or young women counseled as to maybe, you know, if they don't want the child to put the child up for adoption? Because, as you know, Senator Calkill, you and I know many families who would love to adopt young babies. So I'm just curious, does that go on during this process?
Mr. Chairman, yes. The answer is yes. Not enough. That's the other answer. Some years ago, we put an informed consent law in that endeavored to get them information on what services were available, both to them before and after an abortion, or should they seek an adoption. But I'll just quote this from the induced termination pregnancy stats. Most women, that is 76%, who undergo an induced termination pregnancy did not request a copy of the informed consent. And that was litigated. We tried to say you had to get it, but now it is only if they ask for it. And that's part of the problem. However, 4.9% did report receiving a copy of the information contained in the informed consent website. So some years ago, we pushed forward to say they should be fully informed as to what services are available to them. The best we could do was say you can ask for it. And we tried to make it mandatory, but we failed on that account.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Calkill. I just got a note here that the floor has been delayed till 10:30. So, if
good
committee's willing, we'll just keep going here. If there's no other additional questions for the sponsor, I would like to have Commissioner Sturr join us. Thank you, Senator Calkill.
Thank you,
Chairman. Morning, Commissioner.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner, so you've heard some of the questions we've had concerning the costs, and then also if you could maybe talk to us a little bit about the indeterminate fiscal note here and maybe be a little more specific than just indeterminate. But I know you can't be exactly specific. But I guess I'm curious, too, as to Medicaid in Alaska, is it at 60-40, is it 50-50, is it, and as you heard, most of them don't qualify for the 100%. Maybe you could just share some light on those questions as well.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Stewart, Commissioner of Department of Health and Social Services. To answer the question about is it 50-50, is it 60-40, is it 70-30, I don't know, and I don't think anyone knows. And part of our desire last year when we began a rule promulgation or regulation promulgation process to institute a form to be filled out by the physician indicating that it was either the result of rape, incest, or the health of the imminent health of the mother under Hyde, or under the state Supreme Court decision, they had to certify that and they had to put it in writing. If it was a result of rape or incest, we required a non-notarized statement from the woman presenting that their pregnancy was a result of rape or incest and became part of the medical record for that case. And so, you know, we have taken steps, but the process is just underway. The form is being used. We've had some voluntary soft implementation of the form by some physicians, but we don't have enough data yet. Going forward in the next year, I will have data. They will be certified by the physician as being either medically necessary under the state Supreme Court decision or Hyde, which rape, incest, or the imminent health of the mother. So, does that help? In terms of the fiscal note, that's why it's an indeterminate fiscal note, because I don't think anyone really knows what impact it's going to have. Last year we spent $191,000 on abortions. They were all paid for with state general funds, so they were determined covered under the state Supreme Court decision. And while we'd like to think that the majority of those, if not all of those, were medically necessary, meeting the state Supreme Court decision prior to this year, we did not have that information.
Senator Dunleavy?
Is there a possibility, if it doesn't exist already, is there a possibility to do separate accounting within the Medicaid so that we can break out what is federal funding and dedicate that federal funding stream to this process so that Alaskans that don't want to support abortions can, I guess, I don't know what the term is, feel better that we are, for those that are not, that don't want to support abortion, is there any way to break that out within, do a separate accounting system?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, if I understand your question correctly, is there a way to separate Hyde covered abortions from the state general fund covered abortions? And we would do that. However, we aren't collecting any data up until this new form was implemented. We were not collecting any data whether it was federally covered or state covered, so we paid for all of them under state general funds. That was $191,000 expenditure last year.
Just a follow-up, is there any way to just dedicate federal money to the concept of abortion, period, within a separate accounting process within our Medicaid system?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, no. That's a short answer, because the federal government will only pay their portion of the Medicaid, the FMAP, if you will, the federal participation, for the cost of Hyde-covered medically necessary abortions, those rape, incest, or the imminent health of the mother.
Senator Firkla?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that we all know that this is not a pro-life or a pro-choice discussion. This is trying to react and complete the cycle from a court case to define medically necessary in Alaska state statute. So from that basis, if we're looking at the consequence then of the department receiving a checkbox or whatever certification form, is that right? Can I get a copy of whatever that certification form looks like so that I can just see what we're asking doctors to fill out? And then I believe, Commissioner, you just said that there's a doctor's patient would fill out a non-certified form indicating that they were that the pregnancy was a result of rape or incest, and then that becomes part of their medical record, and that is submitted to you. Is there currently any other submissions to anywhere else when we do that? Does the department go right now and submit that information anywhere else?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, the form is not submitted. The form that is submitted to us is a certification from the doctor. And the certification includes, due to rape or incest, the health of the mother, or state general fund only, the abortion was performed, was not an elective procedure. I certify that in my professional judgment. The abortion was performed due to the health of the mother being endangered by the pregnancy. Those are the only ways that they could receive reimbursement. They do not submit the mother's non-notarized statement. They just submit this form, and it goes to our medical reviewers, and then it's that prompts a payment for the abortion.
Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the patient's name blinded then in there in that data that's coming to you? Do you have just an identification number, or is the patient who the procedure is being performed for included in the form? Do you know?
Senator Faircloth, through the chair, the patient's name and their Medicaid ID number are provided to us so that we can link the payment to the individual.
Thank you.
Senator Faircloth. Commissioner Sturr, you gave us the cost to the state, $191,000, and I understand that's just the state's share. Just what, in your best estimation, and I think we have some doctors available too to help, but what is the total cost of abortion procedure?
Ballpark? Mr. Chairman, I don't have that off the top of my head. I can provide that information within the hour.
But the reason why I ask if it was 100% paid by the patient, I'm just trying to figure out what that impact would be to the patient. Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I did the math, and just a quick math, $191,000 divided by 623 paid last year was $307 per abortion or procedure.
$307?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you. Senator Dunleavy?
Thank you, through the chair. Before, I guess it's the TAN decision, almost a decade ago. What was the process? How was it different then than it is now as a result of that court action? If you could just give me a brief synopsis.
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I'm not sure I really understand the question.
What did the TAN decision do that changed things? How did that change what was done before to where we're at now, and we're now at the point of discussing what is medically necessary and what is not?
Senator Dunleavy, what changed is with the Supreme Court decision, we considerably expanded the coverage for abortions in the state of Alaska. With HIDE only, it's rape, incest, or the imminent health of the mother. And it's very restrictive. By adding the Supreme Court decision, we expanded that considerably, and I don't know if I'm getting to your question. So,
I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Okay. Additional questions for Commissioner? Seeing none. Thank you, Commissioner, for joining us today. I think at this point, let's just take a brief at ease. I have some people online here, but I would like to talk to the sponsor first. So brief at ease. Okay, I'm going to bring the Senate Finance back to order. We do have a couple of doctors who have been, who are online and who have offered to give invited testimony on this subject. So I think we'll go ahead and hear from these the two doctors, and then we'll have to go to the floor session this afternoon. Then we'll hear from the Department of Law, hopefully address Senator Fairclough's questions. We'll have invited testimony from Planned Parenthood, as well as probably the Alaska Family Council. And that will be the invited testimony this afternoon. And then, as I mentioned, then we want to hear from the public tomorrow. So with that, let's see. I think let's start with the we have a doctor calling in from out of state, John Thorpe. And I know doctors are have busy schedules. I appreciate them hanging on here. Is he still with us?
Yes, sir. I'm still on.
Okay, good. Dr. Thorpe, are you a medical doctor or professor?
Unfortunately, I'm both.
You're both. Okay, excellent. All right. Well, go ahead with your testimony, sir, doctor.
Well, I'm a physician and practitioner of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of North Carolina, and I worked with the senator who I think drafted the bill in constructing the medical conditions that were and tried to define those that would be a clear and imminent threat to a mother's health, threaten her life. And my testimony would be that I think the list is comprehensive and should cover an array of medical conditions, all of them being very rare, but that might arise and need for at least a reproductive age woman to consider termination of pregnancy. I'll stop there, and if people have questions or comments, I'm happy to try to answer them.
Okay. Well, we appreciate your testimony, and you said you've been working with the sponsor, Senator Coghill?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And his staff.
And staff. Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. Well, they're both here, and they've been they gave the testimony, so I think we understand the bill fairly well. So I do appreciate your assistance.
Yeah, I hope they're nodding their heads and saying, "I know who he is."
Yeah. You know, I don't think we have the best connection. So thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Thorpe.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's go on now to, is it Dr. Bramer, in physician in Fairbanks?
Yes, hello. This is Dr. Bramer. I'm a medical doctor, and I'm currently living in Fairbanks. I'm an OBGYN. I also work with the CareNet of the Tanana Valley Pregnancy Center. But, you know, I've been looking at this for the last little bit and, you know, really feel that this is truly just an economic issue that, you know, really relates to just payment issues. It does not infringe on any of the rights, the access, the safety issues that have been brought up. And so none of those concerns are really valid. You know, the question came up about second opinions, and in my experience, Medicaid and all other insurances have always allowed patients to seek a second opinion when they have met with a physician or other provider when they haven't gotten the answers they wanted or didn't feel like the relationship was what it needed to be, if the personalities didn't click. And so I don't see that that would be any concern in this issue, as it isn't a concern in any other issue. So I'm definitely happy to answer any questions, and, you know, I just appreciate Senator Coghill taking this up.
Okay. We do have a question from Senator Fairclough.
Good morning, Doctor. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Can you help me understand when you fill out the certification form, if you've ever done one first that listed rape or incest?
I do not perform abortions. That's, you know, just an ethical decision that I've made. I did actually participate in one as a resident, and it was under a very extreme case where the patient had a severe heart condition that we knew that she had at least a 50% or higher chance of dying during the pregnancy because of her heart condition. And so after reviewing through the ethics committee at the university where I was trained, and meeting with many members of the, you know, the other physicians and my attendings, you know, we did determine that in that scenario it was, you know, it was medically necessary, and therefore we counseled the patient. Also, while she was under anesthesia to have the abortion done, we also implanted a birth control so that hopefully that issue would not arise again. So that's the only abortion I've ever been involved with. So I can't really state the certification. However, you know, whenever you submit claims to Medicaid or any other insurances, most of it goes under billing codes, and that's kind of the way I would see that most of this, you know, would really be tracked. I'm sure there's an additional form, but, you know, the billing code should be able to clarify what the abortion was done for, which of the requirements under the different lists that's in the bill that it would be associated with, and then, you know, rape or incest, obviously we probably have a separate one, even though that seems to be such a very small number of the ones included.
Thank you, Dr. Bremer.
Thank you, Dr. Bremer. You know, we have the commissioner here, and I think we failed to ask him this question, and you alluded to it as to whether or not a second opinion is paid for by Medicaid. What was your understanding?
My understanding is that it would be covered because it would simply be a level visit and coded, you know, normally. So I would not see that as any concern whatsoever.
Okay, very good. And the commissioner is shaking his head in agreement. So very good.
Okay.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, and as I mentioned, we do... you know, I don't want to get too deep into the judiciary side of this, but I think you have some legitimate questions that we need Department of Law to address in order to move the bill forward. So we'll hear from them this afternoon. We'll hear from both sides, the various advocacy groups on both sides of this issue, Family Policy Council, and then also Planned Parenthood. And then, as I mentioned, then we'll do the we'll hear from the public on Saturday. And if there's any other folks that the committee would like to hear from, then we can certainly invite them as well this afternoon. Otherwise, we will stand in recess until 1:30 this afternoon. All right. We're call the Senate Finance back from our recess. Let's see. When we left this morning, we were discussing Senate Bill 49. And let's see. I don't think I'd take a the. Well, we have Co-Chairman Kelly, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, and Vice Chair Fairclough. And we're going to follow up on some questions. Department of Law, we had some questions for you folks in particular. We were going to take just some invited testimony this afternoon from Planned Parenthood and then also the Alaska Family Council. We were not able to get a hold of either one, so we'll make this invitation, same invitation to them tomorrow when we have the public testimony. And then we do have the sponsors, trustee chief of staff here, and she will answer any questions that may come up for the sponsor. And of course, we have the commissioner still here. So with that, let's go right to Department of Law, and if you could put your name on the record for us, Stacey.
Thank you. My name is Stacey Crayley, the Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law.
Okay, thank you very much. And then I don't know if you, I don't remember if you were here this morning and heard the questions or if you'd like Senator Fairclough to repeat them.
Well, I did take some notes. So
before you get started, I want to welcome Senator Olson. So, okay, there you go. Floor is yours.
Sorry. I did take a few notes so I can kind of start a little bit of answering what I think the questions were posed, and of course if that generates follow-up or clarification, you know, I'm happy to veer off into whatever might come up. As I understand the question that was asked earlier this morning, it was there were two kind of components to it, one of which relates to mandatory reporting in the context of the Hyde Amendment provision, where the state can seek federal reimbursement under the Medicaid Act for an abortion that is the result of rape or incest, and how if a woman or a comes into a doctor's office and seeks services and determines that she wants to have an abortion and self-reports that it was the result of rape or incest, how is that information transmitted outside of the privacy of that doctor's office, either through mandatory reporting or otherwise? And then a kind of a secondary component of that question was how HIPAA may or may not affect that. And so I'll try and respond to both of those questions, and I think that's basically what the senator was looking for. So there's two different constructs here that we need to think about, one of which is when we're dealing with adults and one when we're dealing with minors. And so with respect to adults, there is no requirement. So if, a 25-year-old, just for illustrative purposes, comes into a doctor's office, they determine she's pregnant, and she reports that she has been raped and she wants an abortion, that information is private between the adult woman and her doctor. And the doctor would not have any mechanism to release that information outside of the privacy of that doctor-patient relationship under HIPAA. With one exception, if the woman who reported was a vulnerable adult or had some capacity or competency issues. At that point, the doctor would be considered a mandatory reporter for that purpose and would have to make a report to the Adult Protective Services section of the Department of Health and Social Services. Otherwise, that information is solely within the purview of the doctor-patient relationship and would not be redisclosed outside of that, absent consent by the woman that be disclosed. With minors, it's a little bit different. Physicians are mandatory reporters under Title 47, under 4717.020, and if a minor came into a doctor's office and they discovered that the minor was pregnant and that the minor wanted to have an abortion, there's other concerns and considerations of parental notification law and some other things that play into that, but taking all that issue to aside. If a minor came into a doctor's office and they determined she was pregnant and that the perpetrator of that offense of the assault against the minor was somebody who was responsible for the care of that child, then the physician would have a mandatory requirement under the statute to report that to the Office of Children's Services, which would then also be a report to law enforcement. And there's no discretion there. That HIPAA would not protect that confidentiality because our state law requires the disclosure, which means it trumps the HIPAA protections of confidentiality. So the question would, that it would have to be discussed with the physician and the or the physician would have to make a determination of whether or not there's reasonable cause to suspect that the abuse or neglect, i.e. the assault that resulted in the pregnancy, was conducted at the hands of somebody who was responsible for their care, a teacher, a parent, a coach, somebody who had a relationship with the child. And at that point, it would be a mandatory report, and that would trigger those events that you were concerned about, but that's required under state law. If the perpetrator of the offense was not somebody who was responsible for the child's care, there is no mandatory reporting requirement, and that HIPAA confidentiality would trump the redisclosure outside of that doctor-patient relationship.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any additional questions, Senator Fairclough?
Just to note for the record, that's current law now, too.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for Department of Law? Seeing none,
okay.
thank you for joining us today. Okay. Any other questions, concerns? Like I said, we have the sponsor here. We have the commissioner here. The invited testimony we had for this afternoon, we were not able to get a hold of, so we'll hear from them tomorrow. Anything else? Okay. Everybody's ready for Easter weekend, I think. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we will have a testimony, as I mentioned, tomorrow, starting at 1 o'clock. And then Monday, we'll be doing double duty on Monday as well. Let's see what we got here. Looks like we'll hear bills in the morning. Likely this bill will come back as well on Monday morning after the testimony on Saturday. And then we'll, just to kind of give you a heads up here, we'll take up Senate Bill 47, which is stipend for statewide boarding school, Senate Bill 59, oil and gas exploration development, Senate Bill 86, approving the Flint Hill royalty oil shale. And then in the afternoon, we'll start the capital budget, and we'll be going again throughout the whole state, 1:30 starting in Bethel, and continuing into the night with the last one at 7:30. So, but we'll have all the public testimony on one day, on Monday. So that's Monday. Tuesday morning again, we'll have some more bills. Then Tuesday afternoon, and maybe even Tuesday night, take up the capital budget, continue with the capital budget. I guess the plan here is just we'll do bills in the morning, capital budget in the afternoon. Okay, there's nothing else come before the committee. We're adjourned until tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Have a good Easter weekend.